Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Kate Flannery, and I'm the Executive Director of Community Engagement at Syracuse University. I will be your moderator for today. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge, with respect, the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Thursday Morning Roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University's Office of Community Engagement that features prominent newsmakers who discuss current events in Central New York and beyond. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guests and our topic today. The topic is children's behavioral health post-pandemic, and I have the unique pleasure to introduce three wonderful, talented, capable women, Ms. Elizabeth Nolan, Ms. Jean Galley, and Ms. Jennifer Parmalee. Elizabeth Nolan has a LMSW, is the Chief Operating Officer of Hillside, a human service agency which provides behavioral health, child welfare, and youth development services to children and families in Central and Western New York. She is a member of the board of the New York State Coalition for Children's Behavioral Health and has been a member of Thursday Morning Roundtable for over 15 years. Jean Galley also is a licensed mental health, licensed social worker, and is the Director of Residential Services for Hillside's Finger Lakes campus, which provides residential, clinical, educational, and mental health services for children and adolescents. Services on campus are regulated by both the Office of Mental Health and the Office of Children and Family Services. Jean is a social worker who has worked with youth and families in Central New York for over 15 years. Additionally, we have Ms. Jennifer Parmalee. Jennifer is the Deputy Commissioner and Director of Community Services of the Onondaga County Department of Children and Family Services. In this role, she directs and oversees all aspects of planning, program operations, and resource allocation of the Mental Health Services and School-Based Initiative Division. Prior to this position, she served as the Director of School-Based Initiatives and the Director of Children and Youth Services for Onondaga County. She earned her undergraduate degree from Nazareth College and her MPA from the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. She currently serves on the school board for Cazenovia Central School District. It is with great pleasure that I ask them to share their topic this morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Kate, for having us this morning to talk about this very, very important topic and very timely topic. So what I'd like to talk about this morning is the talk a little bit about what the children's behavioral health system looked like pre-pandemic, but spend most of our time today on the impact of the pandemic on children's behavioral health system-wide at the state level, as well as on Hillside and the youth and families that we serve, and then move on to the advocacy agenda. Kate mentioned that I'm on the Coalition for Children's Behavioral Health, and they are advocating even as we speak, for strong behavioral health services throughout our state for children and families. And then I'll hand the floor to Jen to talk about the pandemic's impact on our local system of care and the county's response. So just a quick word, for those who don't know Hillside, Kate said it, said a little bit, our mission is to provide community-based education, residential treatment services in partnership with youth and families. And as Kate said, we serve children who are involved in the child welfare system, the behavioral health system, youth development services for kids and our students in our local schools, and a range of other services. We, in our entire footprint in Central and Western New York, we serve over 10,000 children and families a year, and about 3,000 of those are here in Central New York and Syracuse and the contiguous four counties. So just to set a baseline, when Kate invited us to join today, I realized that we were here just about exactly 4 years ago on March 22nd. So may have spoken with some of you then. Jen and I both were here then, along with a few other colleagues from Hillside. So I shared these stats then. So pre-pandemic, one in five people are diagnosed with a mental health condition. One in 10 children has a serious emotional disturbance. About 20% of children who have emotional disturbance receive treatment from a mental health specialist. And I want to focus there for a minute because the theme throughout at least my comments this morning are about access. That at that time, there was a significant challenge to access for high quality mental health services for children and families. And the pandemic has only made that worse. So that will be, that's what we are working on. And that's some of the solutions that I'll propose at the end address. And then we know the impact of emotional disturbance on school attendance, school dropout, and suicide is a significant public health issue across our country and right here in our community. And then one, the last bullet, at the time, 4 years ago, violence in our community, in our schools was an issue, and that's very real today, as we know. So I just want to kind of say right out of the gate, mental illness does not significantly increase the risk of violence. Actually, in fact, what research tells us is that those with mental illness, both children and adults, are more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence. So in the systems level, where we were, again, pre-pandemic, is that the children's behavioral health system had been significantly underfunded for years. And I remember at that time advocating strongly about how fragile the system was, and that if there weren't investments in the system and increased resources, that children and families wouldn't be able to get the care they need. And what's tragic about that is that we know what works, that early intervention, community-based care works for children and families in terms of giving them what they need to thrive. At that time, we also talked about some improvements that had made within the system, you know, based on that recognition of what worked, investments in the community, but that the reforms had not touched many settings where children were seen. Children were not getting the services that they needed. So before moving to the pandemic, I just want to take a moment to talk about trauma. Now, the good news is I think many more of you, of us, the public, are aware of the impact of trauma now. I think I'm hoping many people on this call have heard of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And this was very significant in the 90s. It just kind of changed all of our work from saying what's wrong with you to saying what happened to you. That understanding the impact that early childhood experiences have on a person's physical and mental health later in life, the significant impact. If we intervene early, we can address that later impact in a much more low cost and effective way. So I mention that because as we go through the presentation this morning, you'll see lots of examples of adverse childhood experiences caused by the pandemic. So the pandemic has had a significant impact on children's behavioral health. And that's kind of the context. I would also say that the pandemic impacted all of us. Everybody, you know, in this meeting this morning can think of ways that, whether small ways or significant ways, that the pandemic has impacted us. When we're talking about some of the vulnerable children and fragile populations impacted by children's behavioral health, what we know about trauma is that it impacts to the extent the seriousness of the trauma, the chronicity of the trauma, up against the person's internal and external resources to deal with that trauma. So if we have children who are already fragile, families that are already fragile, the impact of the pandemic is just all that much more significant. So I'm going to just share some statistics, some research that demonstrates quantitatively the impact of the pandemic on children and family mental health. And then I'm going to pass it to Jean to talk in a little bit of a more personal way, specifically about the impact on children and families we serve, kind of the qualitative impact. So Fair Health, an organization in New York City, released a report a year ago detailing the impacts of the pandemic, and noted that at that very early state, you know, 2020, 2 years ago, mental health claims had already increased significantly for children aged 13 to 18, approximately doubled over the same months of the previous year. And there was a similar pattern for individuals a little older, although the impact was smaller. The United Health Fund, also a year ago, issued a very significant report, research study on the impact of the pandemic over the past year on the physical and emotional health of children, in particular, with particular focus on communities living in poverty and communities of color. And I just want to say it's such a powerful report that Kate has access to that report if anybody wants to ask her for it, or if I'm happy to send it to anybody if you want to email me at enolan@hillside.com. I'm going to share a few slides that specifically relate to our topic this morning, but anybody interested in this topic, it's a very profound report. And really, they were talking about the adverse childhood experience of losing a parent or a caregiver and what that will mean for children currently and in the future if they don't have immediate access to care and treatment that adequately responds to their experience. This is one of the slides from that report. And I share this, not necessarily to go into detail on it. And that report was talking about the long-term cost financially, as well as the human cost to the system long-term from the pandemic. But I'm highlighting it today really to focus on the ways in which the pandemic has impacted children. So the extended summer gap, school closures, and I was here last month or the month before when Superintendent Alessia presented on the impact of the pandemic in the schools. And I think he really painted a picture of how dramatic that impact has been on our children. So disproportionate impact, as the study says, on children of color. Older siblings might fall behind even further because they're caring for younger siblings. Poverty, many families enter poverty. The previous slide talked about 350,000 children new to poverty. That was a year ago. The overall mental health impact. And of course, Jen might comment a little more in her section, but school is where many children receive their mental health services. So when schools were closed, those services were interrupted as well. And then 20% families reported an increase in substance use. And then, of course, the significant life disruptions leading to anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, I share this really to focus on the content. They are commenting on the financial impact on communities. And the study does do a deep dive on Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse as well. Again, if anybody is interested. So here, just talking about the number of different adverse childhood experiences that impact children today and for their lifetime. Depression, PTSD, anxiety, loss of learning, loss of income, loss of connections, which we know are vital for children's development, vital for them to thrive. And then I think finally, before I hand it over to Jean, a few other studies. Just a year ago, the National Physician and Hospital Association declared a national state of emergency in children's mental health, citing the Centers for Disease Control, Youth and Suicide data, and unmet need for services. And I will say, before the pandemic, a public health emergency had been declared because of the lack of psychiatrists, of child psychiatrists in our communities. So that, again, has only become worse during the pandemic as needs have skyrocketed and the system has been impacted. And then according to the National Council for Mental Wellbeing, the demand for substance abuse and mental health services increased 80%. This was in this previous October, a few months ago, in just 3 months previous, had increased 80%, continuing a steady rise that had begun a year before that. And the Coalition for Children's Behavioral Health, in light of all this, and as part of our advocacy efforts, did a survey of all of our member agencies throughout the state and found that 70% had halted intake for services due to workforce shortages. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but everybody in this meeting this morning, of course, knows about the really, really significant workforce shortage. It is devastating, the human service system in general and the children's behavioral health system specifically, which then impacts the access I talked about earlier. Those halting of intake was for residential, for day treatment, for clinical services, for community-based, more general community-based services. So I'll turn it over to Jean. She'll be talking about children who are experiencing one of the highest level of cares. Hillside provides residential treatment to children, but a lot of the issues she'll talk about and trends really impact children you know, throughout the system of care. So Jean?
Thanks, Liz. So as Liz just said, I will be talking specifically about my experience in working with youth in residential care, but again, many of these factors impacted youth prior to coming into residential care, as well as youth in the community as a whole. As most people are aware, residential programs really serve youth with the highest level of need. They're often disconnected from family, they have challenges with coping skills and self-regulation skills, and also a lot, many have experienced significant trauma. Before the pandemic, even coming and continuing through, coming into and experiencing residential care is a trauma in and of itself. So during this time, we've been working and treating children and families who have experienced significant trauma or in a traumatizing event that have happened during a traumatizing world event, which has really just impacted their experience and has also changed how we've had to do things. So one of the biggest impacts is the loss of pro-social attachments. So similar for youth in residential, as the world has shut down, they have also lost the ability to connect with people in a supportive and pro-social way. Some of the biggest groups that have been vulnerable are adolescents who have then turned to ways like social media and TikTok and other ways to connect with people that has not been the most pro-social way, which has led to feelings of more isolation, bullying, abandonment, anxiety. So we've seen kids coming into residential care during this time where they've lost, they in general struggle with how to connect with people pro-socially, and they've been isolated on top of that. So then what does that look like? They're now living with 8 or 9 of their peers, and how do you get along with your peers becomes even more of a struggle than it has been before, because we haven't had that experience in quite some time in interacting with others. One of the biggest challenges and impact was around reduced home time and family visits. So this has certainly looked different the last 2 years during the course of the pandemic. We've changed our practices and our policies over time based on what was happening in risk level, but it created a tremendous amount of stress for the kids and their families. So at the start of the pandemic, we certainly had youth who were in program and we were not sure what was gonna happen. So we had to have a lot of conversation with family up front and pretty quickly about what they wanted to do, because we didn't know how visitation was gonna continue, and we were making a decision eventually to stop visitation. So families really had to make a very stressful decision about, do you want your child at home for an extended amount of time and there's some risk there, or you're taking the risk of not seeing your child and we're not sure when we can have visitation resume. So that initially was a huge stress for families. Each family made their own personal decision that we supported them with. And for kids who weren't able to have family visits, there was periods of time where they were very isolated on campus. So I have like one specific example. We had a 10-year-old boy who, because of how he presented his home, wasn't able to do extended time at home. So his family would come by multiple times a week and leave gift baskets outside of our door for him. So he could not go out and see them and say hello. And they couldn't come in, but they would leave all these things because they wanted to stay connected. The impact this has also had is our goal is to always have kids return home. And a lot of that work has to happen because they need to see their families. We can't work on what needs to work on in the home environment without having that contact. So for those situations where kids were not able to have family contact and visits, it really has stalled some of the clinical treatment that has needed to happen because we haven't had those real in-life experiences to work with. For the kids and the families, it's also created a lot of stress because even when we've had visitation and it's able to occur, it's always impacted by quarantines, exposures and things like that. So there's increased anxiety with the kids around being able to see their families, because even now when we allow family visitation, they don't always trust that it's going to happen. So they may have plans for something to happen and they know that Friday morning before they leave, we can come and we might say, hey, you've had a COVID exposure and now you can't come, or mom has had a COVID exposure and you're not able to come. So it's created, again, a lot of uncertainty, and attachment is a big piece a lot of the kids need to work with their families and work through some of their trauma. And it's just been delayed because we've continued to add these disconnects in there. So that's the family piece. The next two are about school. So similar to kids in the community, kids in residential followed the same pieces and they had school closures. So they lost out seeing their teachers. The teachers are a big part of their day. They missed seeing other kids on campus, and they were confined. When we closed school, the kids were confined to their living units and with the same peers day in and day out. One of the biggest challenges is that they lost a lot of academic supports and resources. So youth in residential have often not had the most positive school experiences, and that is also an area that we continue to work with them on. They're behind in learning. They need that additional academic support. And while our direct care staff were doing the best job that they could with providing, you know, helping them with their schoolwork, and our teachers were Zooming with them, it just was not always meeting their needs that they had academically. So we've, you know, again, similar, seen some kids with that are continuing to be behind in school. The other piece of it is, I think there's now some fatigue with school. So the last 2 years, kids have not consistently been in school. And actually this school year, this mark in time, I think is the longest kids have been in school in the last 2 years. So we're seeing them getting tired out at this time of year, which we normally would see kind of happen at the end of the end of June. But their tolerance for school has certainly changed. So we're seeing kids walking out of the classroom more, trying to avoid some academic work more, and really trying to do that catch up. And academics is also an area where kids do not feel confident, and that can result in what appears to be behavioral difficulties, refusal to do work, disruptions in classroom. And a lot of it is because, again, it's contributed to them not feeling like they are capable of doing some of the academic tasks at hand. Throughout these last 2 years with the pandemic, we've also seen significant changes in routine. So one of the key pieces of residential, we do a lot of clinical work, but therapeutic work, but to make everything kind of meld together, relationships, consistency, predictability, routine, that's what makes kids feel safe. And that's what allows some of the treatment interventions to work. So we've had to have significant changes in our routine with pausing off-campus activities. We've had to pause campus-wide activities. We used to get everybody we would get everybody together and do big things in the gym. We would have a Thanksgiving dinner. And those are the types of things that we've had to stop doing. We've had to stop having the kids interact and mingle between units sometimes based on what was going on. Off campus is always a big motivator for the kids. And also it's necessary to help integrate them back in the community. And we had long periods of time where we are not having the kids go off campus. We've had to be restricted because we're congregate care setting. So COVID could have a huge impact, and it has, if we've had COVID positive cases. So we had one individual who was in a hospital for some time and then came to us. So she had not been in the community for over a year before we lifted our restrictions to let her into the community. That was a learning curve for her. What was it like to go to a store? Because she hadn't been to one in quite some time. We use those as teaching opportunities, and we lost those. The other pieces, a lot of the off-campus activities were a way for us to separate groups of kids, to give kids different experiences and to also break up some of the dynamics. And instead, we didn't have that. We were kind of all together, and it really challenged the direct care staff to think of different activities and different ways to engage the kids. Winter was very hard because they're almost more cooped up inside. And I do think, though, it provided some, different opportunities that we normally would not have done. So last spring, summer, we had like huge amount of kids that ended up going hiking and doing outdoor activities we more normally would not have done. I think that was a more positive experience, but it did take a lot of creativity on staff's part about how to keep kids engaged and not kind of the monotonous of what was going on. At the start of the pandemic, they started doing activities to be helpful. So they, we had kids made masks on one of the units. The staff taught them how to do that, taught kids cooking skills. So really, it took a little bit of time to get creative about that, but the kids were very excited when we were able to go back in the community, and they advocated pretty strongly to get to return to a sense of normalcy. So that leads into the next thing, which really a lot of this naturally reinforced youth's ability to want to rebel, a tendency to rebel. So we were spending a lot of time saying, you can't go here, you can't go there. So, that of course makes some of the adolescents say, well, I'm just gonna do it anyway. So we really had to work to engage kids to make sure that we were, seeing things more like kids wanting to AWOL, kids wanting to leave, just be in the community. So it took a lot for the staff to kind of get the kids to be engaged in what was happening. This next one we still experience to this day. So like I said, a big part of what we do is the relationships and the predictability. And we have had such unpredictability of staffing due to things like quarantines, isolations, and also changes in the workforce. So it's been challenging for the kids because they're trusting adults have not always been there, and they don't know if they're always going to be there. Kids have said to us, you know, it's harder. Why am I going to trust a new person? You guys keep leaving, or are they really going to be there? It's really created this sense of uncertainty because they're not really sure who's going to be there day to day. You know, there's sometimes we've had staff out for 10 days at a time or longer if staff are sick. We've also had to look how we change how we deliver services and the use of virtual tools, which is been a bit of a challenge for this population. So during different parts of the pandemic, our clinicians have not always been on site. We use virtual tools. If the kids are quarantined or sick, we've had to use virtual tools, and getting the kids to engage over Zoom has been a little bit of a challenge. They've gotten a little bit more used to it, but that definitely was a shift. And again, delayed some of the work that we would normally do. I know that we had, at least at the Finger Lakes campus where I am, the kind of all hands on deck approach. And for the staff, it was really hard when not everybody was there. And when we were limiting when staff were there as a way to, you know, prevent COVID and be safe. But we were losing some things in translation when we were talking about the kids because not everybody could see what's going on. You know, in particular, we really were advocating for some of our psychiatric providers to be back on site, because when we were describing what a kid's crisis was like, something was lost in translation and how we were verbally saying it sometimes when they could see it. So it was, an adjustment for the kids as well as for us. And then the last is, you know, for the kids who are already coming with trauma, anxiety, stress, increased worry about their family. So as Liz was saying, the impacts on families around health and socioeconomic issues, our kids were not immune from that. They experienced that as well. So we've had many kids worry about how their parents are feeling. We've had kids who, when we have family members who have had COVID, have had family members in the hospital, they're not able to be with their families often when those things are happening. So they don't know what's, you know, it's an increase of not knowing what's going on during a very anxious time. It's also been challenging. We've had kids who've been sick themselves. So we've had kids with COVID on campus, and they, you know, when you have COVID, you want to be home with your mom, you want to be home with your family, and they haven't had been able to have that. We've had a lot of families that lost their jobs, job changes, and that certainly has put a stress on their availability and for the kids as well. So overall, I think it's been a lot of change and a lot of adjustment. I do have to say the kids and families are extremely resilient and have kind of worked this all with us. So I'll turn it back over to Liz.
Thank you, Jean. So briefly, because I want to turn it over to Jen and certainly have time for questions at the end. So the advocacy agenda, as hopefully we've demonstrated, the pandemic has negatively impacted an already fragile system. The good news is that we know, as I said, we know what works. Organized public health response can work, but we need to invest in not-for-profit community-based organizations and mental health organizations to be able to provide that response. And really, historically, the nonprofit workforce has been undervalued, workforce of women, workforce from communities of color. And if we don't respond to that gender, wealth, racial gap, we won't be able to develop the workforce that will truly help our children, our families, and then in turn, those families who need to work and are part of the workforce. So this is not an overstatement, this last bullet. We have to invest so the programs don't close. A number of residential and community-based programs across the state have already closed during the pandemic, largely due to some of the workforce challenges, but other challenges created by the pandemic. So that has created significant waiting lists for children and families. So next slide is more good news, is in that the current executive budget does recognize this historic failure to invest, includes investments in human services in general, includes investments in the workforce. And so we are working to support many of the pieces, the components of the governor's budget. She has also recognized the Medicaid managed care transition. I mentioned, you know, a whole transformation of behavioral health services, community-based behavioral health services, really even pre-pandemic wasn't really quite working. So she's also recognized that and included some investments in those systems. So right now, both the Assembly and the Senate have come out with their bills. And there is a lot of good to work with here. The primary theme to kind of some of these issues, addressing rates, addressing the human services cost of living, implementing CPI index for nonprofits. Really, the theme in all this is some of the investments that occurred during the pandemic as the result of relief funds, we're asking that they be increased and made permanent. And then also that we need to also address the needs of non-Medicaid eligible families who have similar needs. We know what works and we need the resources to be able to do it to ensure that children and families who are resilient, as Jean said, have access though to the resources they need to thrive. So with that, I'll hand it over to Jen and really look forward to the discussion at the end.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you for laying such a tremendous foundation and understanding kind of where we are and what has transpired specifically for kids and families through the pandemic. We have locally worked tirelessly to ensure that the state mandates and the state opportunities that have come to us and the federal opportunities that have come to us post-pandemic have been maximized the best way that we possibly can. So we're very excited to talk a little bit about Onondaga's response to the pandemic in relation to children's mental health. So Liz and Jean did a phenomenal job talking about the impact of the pandemic and the stressors associated with the mental health system prior to the pandemic. Here in Onondaga County, between the years of 2016 and 2018, we lost 11 children to suicide under the age of 19. This is a very, very dramatic statistic. There are 11 beautiful lives that were lost. And so we have been thinking about and working on these challenging issues for many, many years. Another statistic that has been one that has really impacted our community dramatically is the increase in emergency room visits for psychiatric reasons here in Syracuse. So in 2015, in one of our emergency rooms, we had 153 children and adolescents come for psychiatric reasons. And in 2018, that number had risen to 1,000 youth. 50% of those children and adolescents were seen for suicidal ideation or an attempt. Prior to the pandemic, we were experiencing record numbers of kids who were struggling at a very significant level, kids and families. One of the pieces of the pandemic, I think the data that Liz put out was so helpful and impactful. And you know, from a county perspective and really thinking about public health, I was really trying to see where are the direct data points that share and show the significance response and needs of kids and families. And so I thought what was really fascinating were some studies that came out that showed that, as we all know, all hospitalizations during the pandemic in that first year of the pandemic, in that first summer of the pandemic, we all went inside. And so people didn't end up going to the hospital unless it was absolutely necessary. However, when you looked at those hospitalizations during that time period, the proportion of mental health visits went up. It increased by 24% for youth aged 5 to 11 and 31% respectively for youth aged 12 to 17. So at the time of, in the spring of 2021, when we as a community were recognizing that, you know, we are coming back to school, right? We are going to be entering into a very new phase of the pandemic that kind of thrust all of us back into life, and recognizing the intense needs of kids and families prior to the pandemic and knowing the intensive impact the pandemic was having, the effort was really at a public health planning phase. So what we tried to look at as a county in terms of how we wanted to respond, we really wanted to look at all kids and recognizing that from an equity perspective, all children were significantly impacted and all families were significantly impacted by the pandemic. When you look at this triangle, I live and die by the triangle. For those of you who are friends of mine, know this is the public health triangle. And what's so beautiful about it is from a scientific perspective, regardless of the population that you're trying to support, if you can apply the public health triangle, you can have tremendous impacts and tremendous positive impacts because you're looking at how you support every single child, every single part of that population. Now, Onondaga County has had a history of working within more urban and more dense suburban districts, school districts, and applying the public health triangle to that work that we were doing. So since 2007, we have been trying to support, for instance, all children in Syracuse City School District and thinking about, well, how do you do that? How do you make sure that you have the right interventions in place for kids ensure that we're able to meet the right level of need for that youth? So the public health triangle is really helpful in terms of, you know, you're going to put an implementation in place for all kids. You're going to collect data and you're going to see how that implementation is working. And for kids and families who are struggling, you're going to design interventions that are going to address those specific individuals struggling and what those struggles are. You're going to collect more data and you're going to continue to do that work. And as you're doing that work, the interventions are getting more complex, more intense, and longer potentially in duration. And so because of that, you're able to support kids and families at a very early intervention stage, as well as really identifying and supporting kids and families when they need that intensive support. And so what this triangle is showing you is our approach to the pandemic or the response to the pandemic. The goal is to ensure that every child in Onondaga County has access to these three services. And the belief system and the theory of change, so to speak, within our public health structure is that kids are in schools. And so the locus of any identification and intervention can be rapidly and effectively improved if we do that work through schools. And so building on our success that we've had within Syracuse City School District, Liverpool, North Syracuse, East Syracuse, Manoah, sorry, and Solvay, we made a pitch to the school districts to say, hey, we would like to take the federal stimulus dollars and invest $5.5 million to ensure that the successes that we've seen within these districts that we've worked in are available to all the districts in Onondaga County. So I'm going to walk through each of these positions to help give people an understanding of what specifically we're looking at. So the first position is at this, what we call tier one level and a little bit of tier two. So this position is a promise zone engagement specialist and it supports all kids in the building. The concept is that you've got an expert in the building in someone who can deliver interventions at a level of maybe, I don't want to say lower need, but a first instance recognition of need in a child. And the work is done actually through the extension of social workers and psychologists. So the true experts in what should be done, determining what that plan should look like, are often those who have the education, the knowledge base, and the history to do that, who are our social workers, our counselors, and our psychologists. This promise zone engagement specialist is someone who can take that knowledge and direction from those individuals and actually be the doer. So often we have psychologists who are spending a ton of their time in testing environments, trying to support individualized kids. This promise zone engagement specialist allows us to support a vast number of children within the building. They're able to provide skill development curriculum within classrooms. They're able to provide groups to kids who may be struggling with, you know, anger issues or struggling with how to work within their building. Maybe they're struggling to tolerate coming back to school, those kinds of things. And they can work individually with youth. So really that last sentence or that second to last sentence around teaching kids to manage emotions using expressive language, that's a lot of what we're training our promise zone specialists to do. And so there are 45, so there's 118 schools in Onondaga County, and there at the time of this implementation or our planning stages, we were looking to, we were in 52 schools. So we were looking to put in some form or fashion in the remainder of schools a level of an FTE. So in many, depending on the size of the schools, we have one full-time person. But then in a lot smaller schools, we recognize let's start with a 0.5, a half-time person, and see if we can establish a relationship and establish the value within those buildings. So the second tier, so really thinking about not just kids, but also families and the experience that families have had throughout this pandemic, we have access liaisons. So in Onondaga County, tremendous work had been done through our system of care work to bring together a no wrong door construct. So kids and families could come to our, and it comes into our access team. So kids and families could come to our access team, whether they had needs related to child welfare, juvenile justice, mental health, school-based, related issues. If their child was struggling in an emotional, behavioral way, if the family was struggling, access was the place that you could go to say, hey, we need support. And we have peers. We have family peer advocates that are a part of that team. We have experts in child welfare, experts in juvenile justice that can help ensure that families can navigate and we can outreach to those families to say, hey, there's more that can be done to support you, and there are more options available for support. So we extended that team by 8 staff, and we connected each of those staff to the districts that had not previously been connected. So prior to the pandemic, we had 52 schools covered with an access liaison, and this access liaison would go to the schools and dialogue with the teachers or the nurses or the social workers or the principals about kids that they were worried about that the school felt could use some outreach and support. And so this team, you know, they get very little information about kids and families. They just know that the kids and families may need some additional support, and they will go knock on the door and they will say, what can we do? We recognize, you know, we hear that you're struggling. How can we support you? And we'll support you in whatever way that you need, whether that be beds or food or support with mental health services for anyone in the family, figuring out how to you know, get your child up for school, because that's a real challenge, especially coming back from the pandemic. The shifts in scheduling have been tremendously challenging. So this team has been incredibly busy and incredibly supportive of kids and families. They do a great job connecting kids and families to schools and making sure that there's really great relationships there, and opportunities, you know, extending opportunities for planning and support, so that the team for that child is the family, providers, and the school. So we can really kind of bring a whole wraparound approach to that, to whatever challenges kids and families may be facing. Another piece that's really important is that they provide technical assistance to school staff. Very often school staff are seeing some very concerning situations that might be occurring, and they may be struggling with how to engage with the family around very complex, challenging situations. Or schools may be trying to understand, should we really be, you know, making that call to child welfare? We, oh, it doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel good. And so our team is there to support them in taking the next step to make sure that kids and families are safe, ensuring that really that we're just kind of there to support and listen to experts who really, I mean, the school social work counselor and psychologist staff, the student support services staff across our county, we are so blessed in our county to have such tremendous professionals working with our kids and families. And sometimes they just kind of feel alone, right? Because they're the other staff within the building are very focused on the academic components, and they just kind of need somebody to help them with these complex situations from a social, emotional, behavioral perspective, or a broader community need perspective. And most of the time they have the answers that they need, but this team is just there to help them with like, yep, you know what you're doing a great job. How can we support you? Okay, so we have a long history in Onondaga County of supporting outpatient mental health satellite clinics, New York State satellite clinics within school buildings. These are a tremendous support for kids and families. So what this looks like is, let's think about, you know, our partners are Arise, Liberty Resources, Helio Health, and Upstate. So we have, you know, thinking about an outpatient clinic that can actually be on site at a school. And there are tremendous benefits to having an outpatient clinic, a therapist on site. They can support determining which children need and then deliver assessment, diagnosis, and treatment right there in the school setting. Some of the benefits of that for kids and families are, it is a tremendously intensive experience trying to support a child through receiving therapy. And oftentimes the times that are available to families to go to these therapy appointments are during school. Or it may mean that a family needs to take a child out of school for hours throughout the day to ensure that their child can get the treatment that they need. And so putting this service into the school, co-locating it within the school, means that kids and families can reduce the number of hours away from the building, reduce the number of hours away from the educational, their actual classes. And it reduces a tremendous amount of stress on that family to ensure that the child is getting the support that they need. Another benefit is the fact that there is a whole team of professionals within the building who are able to participate and collaborate with one another, plan together with that therapist, and ensure that the child can be successful not only in their home and in their community, but also within their school. And I think prior to us embedding mental health clinics into schools, the school had been the toughest partner. And the reason is that they just function at a very different level. Teachers are almost never at a desk where they can answer a phone and have a long conversation about a child and put plans around that kid. Getting to social workers can be really challenging because they are out in the building or out at home visits supporting kids and families. It's just such a different environment. And so co-locating can really help ensure that those connections happen, that those plans can actually occur right there in the moment when necessary. So prior to the pandemic, we had 52 schools that were covered with a outpatient mental health clinic. We now are at a point where we have 84 schools covered of our 118 in Onondaga County. And in reference to some of what Jean and Liz were talking about, a lot of that has to do with workforce shortages right now. And this particular, the individuals that fill these positions are licensed mental health clinicians and licensed social workers. These are some of the hardest staff to hire at this moment in time right now. And we need so many of them across our system. we started the offer that we made to all the schools was that we would figure out a way to get at least a 0.5, so a half-time clinician in every single building. And so we're at a point right now where we're feeling great about the 84 schools that have opened, that are accepting cases and partnering with schools right now. And we've got another 10 that are in process. They're in hiring. They're in the process with New York State Office of Mental Health to license the space, that kind of stuff. And we're expecting next year to support even more of those clinics. So what I'm really excited about is how far we've come since April of 2021. So we have to organize and manage all of this work. And so that's where our school-based coordination and strategic planning and support come from. We have a portion of the work that we do that is managing all of this system and working with schools to develop relationships and help them with what these relationships with outside providers and community agencies coming into the building, what those partnerships need to look like, and how to address any challenges and barriers that arise. So we're supporting all the 19 districts in Onondaga County and all the 118 schools through that strategic support and planning that can look like technical assistance. We provide evidence-based training and then just kind of systems level planning. We will sit down with administrators and just, you know, work with them through problem solving challenges that they experience. So the three boxes at the bottom are the, you know, kind of where we are in terms of our development through our expansion. And so our access liaisons, we are at a point where we are supporting 112 schools now. We have 32 staff. So in April of 2021, we were in 52 schools. So we're really excited about the added level of support that we're providing to families and kids. In terms of outpatient mental health clinics, as I said, we're in 84 schools now, which we're really excited about. And our Promise Zone specialists, we are in 16 of the 19 districts right now. We're in 79 schools and we have 76 staff. And we're excited. Some of this for districts, I think all the districts were very excited about the work that we were bringing to them and the investment that we were making. And I think there are some buildings and districts who are working very hard to address the mental health needs of the population and wanted to partner with us around planning and coordination, and we're in kind of planning stages for what to do next to support. So I think we've been incredibly successful in bringing these services to buildings and kids and families, and we're looking forward to the benefits that it has for kids and families. That's it for me. And I think one of the things that's been really, really essential to think about is outside of the public health construct and recognition that if we can get to kids and families at the stage where they're recognizing a challenge, and help intervene and address that challenge, we are going to be so much better off as a community. And the higher level needs of and supports and services will be able to address the kids that really need them. You know, like without this public health approach, it's really just, you know, we identify kids who come to us because of a crisis, and we want to address that prior, much earlier than that. So I'll stop there. Thank you so much for all that time. Appreciate it.
I'd just like to thank the three of you. This has been so enlightening. I think we all are aware to some extent, I think, the challenges that the pandemic has put forth to our families and our children, but I don't think we understood the level of crisis at which we are facing and the need for interventions and support and the fact that we know what to do. Right? To Liz's point and to all of yours, that we have responses. We need to execute those responses in a thoughtful, data-driven, effective, and efficient way has really been brought home to us by your presentation. There are many questions. We unfortunately are out of time today to get to those. Are you comfortable sharing your slide decks? We can talk about that later with people. And I'll forward those to people who are interested. But I just really want to thank you all for the incredible work that you do. I think also what resonated was the need for more providers, right? For the workforce to be able, and that's a direct reflection of our values in our community. And if we value our children and we value families, we need to then support the people who work with them. And I just really appreciate you bringing that to light. Thank you. I'd like to thank our audience for attending today. really, really special for us. Please join us next Thursday on Thursday Morning Roundtable. We will be having Professor Paula Johnston from the Syracuse University School of Law talking about the Supreme Court nominees and nomination, and that promises to be fascinating as well. I just can't thank our speakers enough. Thank you and have a wonderful day. Very informative. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Thank you.